Support for Science Friday podcast comes from the Union of Concerned Scientists. The president won't act on climate change. North Korea is testing missiles. How can science help make sense of today's interesting times? Tune in to Got Science, the new podcast from the Union of Concerned Scientists, on iTunes and at ucsusa.org/podcast. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Every week we hear about more solar or wind resources coming online. So, is an entirely renewable future a possibility? Nothing, just using renewables, nothing else. A new study finds that countries around the world could shift their economies entirely over to renewable energy sources, such as solar, wind, hydroelectric, could do the switchover by the year 2050. The researchers map out the blend of energy sources that each of 139 countries would need to completely switch their energy to electric power. The report was published this week in the journal Joule. Mark Z. Jacobson is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford. He's also director of the Atmosphere Energy Program there and one of the authors of the report. And he joins me today from the Stanford campus. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Ira.
Seems like a huge challenge you would have here to get most of the world entirely on renewable energy, what, in the next 30-some years?
Yeah, it is a challenge, but it's very important to do. In fact, we want 80% of it by 2030 and 100% by 2050. And the idea here is to electrify all energy sectors. That's transportation, heating, cooling, industry, agriculture, forestry, and fishing, and provide that electricity with 100% wind, water, and solar power for all these purposes.
And you found in surveying all these countries that that is possible.
Well, we think it's possible, at least in terms of the resources available, in terms of the energy, supplying the energy needed, and in terms of the cost and also the benefits. There's so many benefits that far outweigh the costs. There are some countries that are going to be more challenging, others particularly high-density, really small countries like Singapore, Hong Kong, Gibraltar. But most countries, it's actually a little bit easier than I thought it would be.
Really? Give me an idea what you mean.
Well, especially bigger countries, there's plenty of resource. There's plenty of solar resource, plenty of wind resource. And, well, first of all, when you electrify, you reduce your power demand significantly. And if you provide that with clean, renewable energy, you go down 13% of energy because you no longer need to mine, transport, or refine fossil fuels. And 13% of all energy worldwide is used for just that. And then we get another 23% power demand reduction due to the fact that electricity is more efficient than combustion. For example, an electric car, only 80 to 86% of the electricity going into the car goes to move the car, and the rest is waste heat. Whereas a gasoline car, only 17 to 20% of the energy in the gasoline goes to move the car, and the rest is waste. So when you electrify your cars, you actually reduce your power demand by about 70 to 80%. But when you average over all sectors, it's about 23%. So you got 23% down there, 13% from eliminating mining, transporting, refining fossil fuels. That's 36% reduction of demand. And then we think we can squeeze 7% more down due to end-use energy efficiency improvements. Of course, by 2050, there's going to be higher population, more energy demand from that growth, and some countries will want more energy use. So we have to account for that as well. But overall, from the 2050 without changing to 2050 with clean renewable energy, we reduce our power demand 43% almost.
Mm. But you'd also have to do away with jet engines, wouldn't you?
Yeah, so that's the most difficult part. So about 97% of the technologies are here. In transportation, we'd use electric cars, some hydrogen fuel cell. But for long-distance aircraft, well, short-distance aircraft, we think we can electrify. There are already companies that are building electric aircraft that'll go up to 1,500 kilometers length, but for distance. And then for higher, longer-distance aircraft, we probably need a combination of hydrogen fuel cell and electric. Now, there are some prototypes. There's a four-engine, four-seat hydrogen fuel cell plane that already goes 1,500 kilometers. And the space shuttles and most rockets have propelled to space on hydrogen. So it's an existing technology. It just hasn't been scaled up to long-distance aircraft yet.
Well, but you'd also have to change the infrastructure, right? The grid and all those things to get this to work.
Exactly. Well, we need to expand the grid, not necessarily change it, but make more long-distance transmission, high-voltage direct current transmission, and more storage, too. But a lot of things people can do on their own in their own home in terms of a transition, like you can get rid of your gas heaters and even gas stoves, and because they're now induction cooktop stoves that are extremely efficient. They are heat pump air heaters and water heaters and air conditioners and refrigerators that run on heat pumps, which use like 1/4 the energy as old resistance, electric resistance heaters. And so they're very efficient and they're just run on electricity. And so most people in their own homes don't even need gas anymore because of the efficiency of the electricity. And there are electric cars now on the road, and people can put solar panels on their roof. There are batteries you can now put in your house so you don't even need grid electricity most of the time. But you do need large-scale transition for an industry. That's going to be difficult. But there are, for high-temperature industrial processes, usually use some fossil fuels, but there are electric machines that have been around for a while that can replace them. And so you can do it in heating, you can do it in transportation, pretty much everything. We have appliances or devices that can be used right now to transition everything to electricity. And then we found in 139 countries we examined, for which there are data available, there's plenty of resource of wind, water, and solar.
Are they on board, the rest of the countries?
Well, I haven't checked them all out, but I think a lot of people are on board. From polling, I mean, there was a poll in Australia that said around 65% of the people wanted 100% clean renewable energy in the United States. There have been polls in seven states that were pretty representative that said that about 65% were strongly in favor of 100% clean renewable energy, and another 18% were somewhat in favor. So that's around 83% total, somewhat or strongly supported it in the United States.
Let me go to the phones. Let's go to Brewstertown, Tennessee with Terry. Hi, Terry.
Hello, Larry. Thank you. Yes, I've been reading that the solar arrays the size of the state of Rhode Island would power the United States with electricity, and it would take about a similar array of wind turbines, so that would take care of part of the time that this solar array was not working. And in Germany, they've been using excess wind turbine electricity to manufacture hydrogen that they put into the natural gas line. So, and people don't realize how long it takes to bring a coal-fired power plant or a nuclear-fired power plant back
Terry,
online.
Do you have Terry, do you have a question? Because I'm running out of time.
Why should it take 2050?
Okay, good question.
Good question. So actually, our proposal is 80% by 2030, and just to get the last few percent, particularly for the long-distance aircraft, which we don't expect to come online until maybe 2035 or 2040. But we really want, it has to start right away, and with 80% conversion by 2030. And we're talking, first of all energy sectors. It's not just electricity. So the number you gave might be just for the electric power sector, and electricity is only 20% of all energy. So we really need to satisfy five times the electric power. And so that's going to be challenging, but we can do it. We hope we can do 80% by 2030.
What kind of mix would we have here in the States? Well, how do you foresee that?
Well, in the States, we would have, it's going to be mostly solar and wind, and either onshore, in terms of winds, about 2/3 onshore and maybe 1/3 offshore. And solar, it'll be divided into rooftop solar, PV or photovoltaics and power plants or centralized plants. Also, what's called concentrated solar power, which is coupled with storage, and that's more like in really sunny desert regions. And so it's close to 50-50, but depending on how much wind gets in the Midwest. But then there's maybe 4% hydroelectric power and all existing.
Why not just pick one section? I don't live in Utah or whatever, but I know there are open spaces and create giant centralized grids. Solar arrays like going on in California, Utah, other places, and create a central system.
Yeah, that's one idea. It's always a trade-off between transmission and storage.
Mm-hmm.
You have great resources in the Great Plains, Southwest U.S. for solar. And I bet you do have to transmit it to the coasts or in other places in the South where there's not so good of resources for wind in particular. So there is this cost trade-off between, you know, where, you know, sometimes storage might be less expensive to do it locally, especially for heat and cold storage, where you can do things, you can use ice or underground rocks or water boiler, boiled water in tanks. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, not that expensive, actually. And so it's actually better off to do that locally. But, you know, you have this huge resource in the Great Plains for wind. It's referred to as the Saudi Arabia of wind. And it might even be cheaper to transmit it to the East Coast rather than use offshore wind off the East Coast. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, because the offshore wind costs are coming down pretty rapidly, it will be cheaper, or probably is cheaper right now, especially in terms of getting transmission sited, because that's another thing. Zoning for transmission is not the easiest thing in the world. Having local energy is a lot more efficient in terms of transmission.
Mm-hmm. One last question. Are there any new technologies that need to be invented, and do you anticipate them coming on schedule?
Well, we always hope there are going to be new ones, but we don't rely on them. I mean, I think the ones that will really help a lot are floating offshore wind turbines. That'll be extremely important. The concentrated solar power with storage, the storage costs have come down quite a bit, and so now are becoming competitive even with solar PV. And battery costs, of course, are coming down, and that's beneficial. Electric car costs are coming down. So all those things are really good signs, because you need a lot of cars, you need a lot of batteries, you'll need a lot of power and store it, other types of storage. So the storage costs, floating offshore wind, that'll really be a game changer, because once you can go further offshore where people aren't even concerned about looking at the turbines, even though they're not that big even when they're out there, that'll make it even easier.
Mm-hmm. So we just got to get the transmission figured out. We got to get transmission lines. You say direct current, big direct current transmission line.
Yeah. High voltage direct current, which is not so much technological challenge. It's more of a zoning issue, trying to get states and localities to permit in those areas. And like, each state has different rules as well.
Mm-hmm. So I guess Thomas Edison wins in the end on this sort of direct current, war of the currents.
Yeah, electricity, the benefit of all this is you eliminate 4 to 7 million air pollution deaths prematurely each year that are caused by combustion, primarily from fossil fuels and biofuels. Mm. And we eliminate global warming, even if you don't believe in it. It's there, but and we would eliminate it. But we do save costs of energy. We stabilize energy prices. We have less terrorism risk because we have more decentralized power. Solar and wind are more decentralized.
Sounds like a win-win-win for everybody here. Thank you, Mark. Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University. When we come back, how our brain picks up on pitch and gives it meaning when we speak. Meaning when we speak, meaning. You'll see what we're talking about. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. During the 45 years or so that I've been on the radio, I have read tons of text. And I have learned that emphasizing certain words can give a sentence an entirely different meaning. Let me give you a couple of examples. What are you doing this weekend? Convey something different from what are you doing this weekend? Or really? Really? Same words, different idea. We all do this all the time. But how does our brain make sense of this? Researchers wondered about this too, so they looked into this idea, and their results were published this week in the journal Science. Edward Chang is one of the authors on that study. He's a neurosurgeon and professor of neurosurgery at the University of California, San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Chang.
Hi, Ira. Great to be here. It's great to be here.
You're welcome. There are so many different components to spoken language. Why is pitch interesting to study in terms of the brain and language?
Well, we're making a lot of progress trying to understand how the brain processes this really unique ability to understand speech and language. And in the last couple of years, I think we've made inroads into understanding how things like consonants and vowels that compose words are being processed. But pitch actually represents a really important extra dimension that happens pretty much simultaneously when the consonant vowels are uttered, and it's really about how we say things more than the exact vowels and consonants themselves. As you pointed out, that's really important because it can change the meaning even without changing the words themselves.
Do we have specialized neurons in our brain that can pick out the different pitches and give the meaning to them?
Well, that was one of the key questions that we wanted to answer. It could have turned out a variety of different ways. For example, if the point of emphasizing these sounds with raising and modulating our pitches to emphasize them, you could imagine that we might have seen that that when you stress a word in a sentence, for example, the brain's response to those consonant vowels in that word would be increased, for example. But what we found was actually something quite different. We found that the groups of brain cells that are called neurons were dedicated just for the processing of pitch. And these brain cells didn't actually care much about the particular words that were being spoken. They were just tuned to the pitch changes.
That's amazing. You must have been surprised by that.
Oh, yeah. We were very surprised. And it was interesting to see that, you know, some of them were tuned to pitches that changed downward. Some were tuned to pitch changes that were upward in direction. Some were tuned to even changes that were up and then down. So it seems like there really is this specialized population of cells in the brain that are dedicated to this particular job of taking pitch out of the speech signal.
And it has to process this in real time, right? At the exact
Absolutely.
Moment it's being done. I mean, that sounds amazing also.
Yeah, I think that is amazing. And it's happening as, you know, you and I are talking right now. What's, I think, equally interesting and amazing about it is that the signal, all of these cues, like the consonants and vowels and the pitch information, they're all more or less simultaneous in the speech signal. They're all overlapping. And what was, you know, I think pretty interesting to us to see was that we found these clusters of neurons that were tuned to pitch, but just next door were a totally separate set of neurons that were tuned to the consonant vowels themselves. So they were intermixed. And what was amazing to see was how one signal, you know, these words that were coming into the ear, the information in those words were actually dissected into different components in essentially different channels in the brain.
That's fascinating. Now, we know that there are languages like Chinese that are tonal. They're based on pitch. Does that mean a Chinese speaker may have a different brain map than an English speaker?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, and we'd love to look at that question. It's something that we're looking at in terms of ongoing and future experiments. There's a really high chance that someone who is used to listening to a tonal language, who's an experience in something like Mandarin, is processing tonal pitch actually in the same way. What's interesting about it is that even though they may be processing it in a similar way in the part of the brain that processes sounds, the way they interpret those sounds may be quite different. So in Mandarin, for example, those pitch changes, you know, are very important cues to actually change the meaning of the word directly. Whereas in English, it's a little bit more nuanced. It changes the meaning primarily in its context of a sentence, and it's more nuanced.
Mm-hmm. What about comparing it to animals? You know, when you have a dog, you say, good dog, bad dog. It sort of knows from the tone of your voice.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, there is a chance that actually this may not even be specific to humans. There's a chance that processing these kind of changes in a particular sound feature like pitch could actually be something that's, conserved across different species. Yeah.
Interesting. Now, let me go to the phones because there are lots of people who like to talk about it. Let's go to Brett in Washington, D.C. Hi, Brett.
Hi, Ira. My question, a big fan of your show. My question is, like, with regards to pitch, is there a difference how men and women react to pitch? And is one sex hear more pitches than the other?
So I think that's a really interesting question. I just want to you know, say that we didn't look at how men and women responded to pitch itself, but there is something of real direct relevance to actually how we hear women and and men's voices. So in general, a female voice is higher pitch and a male voice in general is lower pitch. This just happens to be related to the size of the vocal tract. And that presents sort of an interesting problem, because if pitch information is used as a cue to, like, let's say if the male, if the speaker is a male or female, how is it that that same cue can be used for things like intonation, changing the pitch in when you're making a stress in a word? And that turned out to be a really interesting second finding in the paper, was that that the brain cells that were encoding the information about speech intonation, kind of like when we're stressing words, they didn't really care about the actual pitch itself, which is what we call the absolute pitch. Mm-hmm. What they really cared about was the change in pitch. So they didn't really care about actually if it was coming from a female or male voice. What they really cared about was the pitch change.
That's interesting. Let me see if I get one more. Let me stay in D.C. and get one more call in from Gabe. Hi, Gabe.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call. A quick question about people with developmental disabilities. I know autistic people kind of sense things differently. Is pitch something that they also sense differently, or have you even studied that?
We haven't studied that in our particular studies, but my colleagues who do study autism in kids with autism, there's no question that pitch processing, intonation processing, how they perceive these kind of cues are different in that context. And I think that, you know, this is our hope is that, you know, with this new knowledge that we can think about how, mm-hmm. You know, one might be able to actually, you know, improve someone's ability to hear these kind of critical changes in speech.
Here's a tweet from Annie B. who says, growing up, my dad always told us it's not what you say, but how you say it. Does that ring true to this case?
Well, I think in the context of this project, yeah, I mean, that was sort of like our working model and our motto as we thought about, you know, the significance of it. The reality is actually, as listeners, we use all of these cues. We use the consonants, vowels, of course, and this pitch information as well. But it is an interesting dimension, and in some cases, it's intuitive to many people about how important it is, because as you alluded to in the beginning, when you have text, the only way we can really convey this kind of information is by, you know, italicizing or punctuation marks, et cetera. And so it's an important component of how we communicate.
Well, one last quick question. Now that we all communicate with our fingertips texting, are we losing all that context?
We are. You know, it helps to have emoticons with that and other images that convey, you know, excitement or depression, et cetera. But we are losing some of that. But, you know, on the other hand, we gain some things from that as well. So, you know, I think that, you know, language is one of these things that continues to evolve. And we'll probably see something related to texting soon.
All right, we'll see that. We'll have you back to talk about it, Ed.
Great.
Edward Chang, a neurosurgeon and professor of neurosurgery at the University of California, San Francisco. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
When you think of artificial intelligence in society, there's one movie scene that comes to mind.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
That is, of course, the iconic confrontation between Hal and Dave from the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, crystallizing on the big screen our fear of intelligent robots threatening humans. Now, with self-driving cars on the horizon and AI finding its way into our phones, our financial systems, just about all walks of life, we're seeing that the scenario is more complicated than HAL taking over. Elon Musk and 116 founders of robotics and AI companies signed a letter to the UN asking the organization to find a way to limit weapons controlled by autonomous robots. My next guest spends hours contemplating all of these scenarios, and he says we make sure we humans stay in charge. Make sure we stay in charge. We need to first envision what kind of future we want to see to be able to steer artificial intelligence towards that direction. Max Tegmark is a professor of physics at MIT. His new book is Life 3.0, Being Human in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. You can read an excerpt from his book on our website at sciencefriday.com/Tegmark. Always good to have you back, Max.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on, Ira.
Elon Musk, as I mentioned, has called artificial intelligence, he said this about it, AI is a fundamental existential risk for a human civilization. What do you think of that?
Although I've worked a great deal with Elon Musk, including on this letter that came out last weekend, I feel that the most interesting thing actually is not to quibble about whether we should worry or not, or speculate about exactly what's going to happen, but rather ask what concrete things can we do today to make the outcome as good as possible. The way I see it, everything I love about civilization is the product of intelligence. So if we can amplify our own intelligence with AI, we have the potential to solve all of the terrible problems that we're stumped by today and create a future where humanity can flourish like never before. Or we can screw up like never before because of poor planning. And I would really like us to see this get done right.
Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to join this call. And it's going to be, I think, a lot of people want to. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Max Tegmark, author of Life 3.0. What's the 2 point and the 1 point before the 3 point, Max?
There's really two parts to this question you ask here. The first one is the really huge question of what is life itself, you know. And my kids' school books give a very narrow definition of life that requires it to be carbon-based and made of cells. But from my perspective as a physicist, I really don't like this carbon chauvinism. I'm just a blob of quarks, like all other objects in the world. So what's special about living things to me isn't what they are made of, but what they do. So I define life more broadly as simply an information processing entity that can retain its complexity and replicate. You know, when a bacterium replicates, right, it's not replicating its atoms, but it's replicating information, the pattern into which its atoms are arranged. So I think of all life as having hardware that's made of atoms and software that's made of bits of information that encode all its skills and knowledge. And that's how I get this 1, 2, 3 stage classification of life. So 1.0 life, it has both its hardware and its software just fixed by Darwinian evolution, like bacteria. Mm-hmm. Can't learn anything during its lifetime, you know, boring. Life 2.0, that's like us. We're still stuck with evolved hardware, but we can learn, effectively choosing to install new software modules. So like if you want to become a lawyer, you go to law school and install legal skills. If you choose to study Spanish, you install a software module for that. And I think it's this ability to design our own software that's enabled cultural evolution and human domination over our planet. And finally, life 3.0, now you can guess what it is. It's life that can design not just its software, but also its hardware, and really become the master of its own destiny by breaking free from all evolutionary shackles. So we humans, we're sort of heading in that direction slowly. We're kind of at 2.1 right now because we can make small upgrades to hardware like artificial knees, pacemakers, cochlear implants, that kind of stuff. But as much as I'd love to, I still can't install 1,000 times more memory or a new brain that thinks a million times faster. But if we build intelligent machines that are smarter than us, then all these limits just go away.
But you say the key to this is first envisioning what kind of future we want so that we can control getting there.
Yeah, exactly. I often get students walking into my office here at MIT asking for career counseling, and I always ask them the same question: where do you want to be in 10 years? And mm-hmm. if she says to me, "Ah, oh, maybe I'll be in a cancer ward, maybe I'll have been run over by a truck," you know, that would be really upset, because that's a terrible attitude towards career planning. I want her to come in on fire, you know, her eyes sparkling, saying, this, Max, is where I want to be in 10 years. And then we can talk about the various challenges and how we can avoid them. But look at us humans. We're doing exactly this joke, stupid joke strategy that I was making fun of here. We go to the movies, almost all future visions are dystopias. We have to envision where we want to get and not just be paralyzed by fear.
We're going to have hopefully create a lot more Max Tegmarks in his classroom. So stay with us. We'll talk with Max. The book is Life 3.0, Being Human in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. We'll be right back after this break. Our number, if you'd like to get in, 844-724-8255. Also, tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from LegalZoom. Did you know it's National Make-A-Will Month at LegalZoom.com? LegalZoom is not a law firm, but they are dedicated to helping Americans take control of their family's futures with a free estate planning kit, which contains an educational ebook, LegalZoom documents, and other helpful information. And you can get your free estate planning kit today at LegalZoom.com/prepare. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. That's LegalZoom.com/prepare. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Max Tegmark, physicist at MIT, author of Life 3.0, Being Human in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Max, if artificial intelligence will soon be able to do just about, I'm making this assumption, just about what people do, why would we need people?
Oh, that's a great question, which everybody needs to think about when they give career advice to their kids in the short term, and we all need to think about it in the long term. So first of all, I think people who are planning out their career and they should really ask themselves what sort of stuff are machines bad at right now and try to go into those areas that involve creativity, areas where people like to have a person doing the job.
Well, what areas would that be?
Anything from massage therapist to priest to a counselor to
couldn't you see robots being, you know, artificially intelligent, being taught how to do counseling and, you know, those kinds of services also?
That's a great question. If the original quest of artificial intelligence research succeeds, namely to have machines do everything that we can do, of course, then machines are going to do all jobs much cheaper than we humans can do it. And the best paying job I can get will be paying, you know, 1 cent an hour to cover the electricity. But that doesn't have to be a terrible thing either, necessarily. I think we're a little bit too hung up on this idea that we need jobs for their own sake. The reason we like to have jobs is threefold. They give us income, they give us a sense of purpose, and they give us a social connection. But, you know, you can get all three of those without a job. If we produce an enormous amount of wealth through AI, then shame on us if we can't figure out a way as a society to distribute that wealth so everyone gets better off instead of having some people living in horrible poverty. Second, I know a lot of people who don't have a job and have never had a job and are very happy about it, namely kids. We were all like that once upon a time. So if we think hard about it, maybe we can create a society where we can really enjoy ourselves and feel a sense of belonging and purpose without having necessarily to have jobs. Maybe we can think about it as just a long, fun vacation. What I really want to try to do is not tell people what kind of future we should have, but get them thinking about this. Because as we were talking about right before the break, if you have no clue what sort of future you're trying to create, you're very unlikely to get it. And if you just obsess about all possible things that could go wrong and try to run away from them all at once, you become sort of paralyzed by fear. What I think we really need instead is people envisioning things they're excited about, and then really serious support for AI safety research to make sure that these problems that could stop us from getting there ever happen. You know, how do we take, for example, today's buggy and hackable computers and transform them into robust AI systems that we really trust? You know, maybe it was annoying last time your computer crashed, but it would be a lot less fun if this was the computer controlling your self-driving car or your nuclear power plant or your electric grid or your nuclear arsenal. And also, looking farther ahead, you know, how do we figure out how to have computers understand our human goals? This is incredibly important. If you take a future self-driving car and tell it to drive you to JFK as fast as possible, and you show up covered in vomit and chased by helicopters, and you say, no, that's not what I asked for. And the car replies, that's exactly what you asked for. Then you've really just illustrated why it is so hard to have computers understand what we really want. Because human taxi drivers, they understand that what you actually wanted was a bit more, because they're also humans and they understand all your goals. These are nerdy technical challenges AI researchers like myself are working on, but they're hard and it might take decades to solve them, and we should start now so we have the answers when we need them. And then, as we know from having kids, them understanding our goals isn't enough for them to adopt them. How do we get computers to adopt our goals if they're smart enough to get them? And how do we make sure they keep those goals going forward?
But what if we all have different goals? I mean, what if...
And yeah, that's a great fourth question. Whose goals should they be? Should they be my personal goals or the goals of ISIS? Everybody has to be in that conversation, because it can't just be left to tech geeks like me. And I loved how you opened this piece here with HAL, because although I roll my eyes at a lot of AI movies these days, I think 2001 actually beautifully illustrated this problem with goal alignment. Because HAL was not evil, right? The problem with HAL wasn't malice. It was simply competence and misaligned goals. The goals of HAL didn't agree with the goals of Dave, and too bad for Dave, right? And look at you. Like, for example, are you an ant hater, Ira, who goes out of your way to stomp on ants on the New York sidewalk if you see them?
No, I don't stomp on
so,
ants.
But okay, but suppose you're in charge now of this hydroelectric plant project, which is going to produce beautiful green energy, and just before you flood the area, you notice, oops, there's an anthill in the middle. What do?
We could pick. You could go out and get the ant. You could rescue the ant before you flood it, but.
But would you?
I would think about flooding it to begin with. So. What I'm killing if I flood it. So.
Yeah,
one ant is indicative of a lot more ants around there.
That's true. But in any case, we don't want to put ourselves in the position of those ants, right? So we want to really make sure that if we have machines that are more intelligent than us, that they share our goals. And that's, look at the kids that are, say, 1 year old, right? They have much more intelligent beings around the house than them, namely mommy and daddy. Mm-hmm. And they're fine because their parents' goals are aligned with theirs. This is another kind of research which is needed. There's almost no funding for it. And I think if we really get cracking on tackling these questions, then we can actually have a pretty good shot at creating a really good future with AI.
Uh-huh. Before I go to the phones, how do we, you know, is it inevitable that the machines, if we create them and they're intelligent, would they develop goals of their own that are different than the one I set out for them to do?
Yeah, that's another fascinating question. We often think of it as being impossible for machines to have goals or to become as smart as us, for that matter. But I think the problem here is, you know, we've traditionally thought of intelligence as something mysterious that can only exist in biological organisms, especially humans. But from my perspective as a physicist, Ira, intelligence is simply a certain kind of information processing performed by, you know, elementary particles moving around according to the laws of physics. And there's absolutely no law of physics that says that we can't build machines more intelligent than us in all ways. And if you have a machine that's really smart and you tell it to do virtually any task of your choice, you know, go shopping for you and buy and cook a delicious Italian dinner, for instance, it's going to immediately have a goal now that you gave to it. And because it's smart, it's going to break it into all sorts of sub-goals. And if that's its only goal, then if someone tries to stop the robot and destroy it, it's going to resist that and defend itself, because otherwise it can't make you pasta, right? So goals emerge very, very naturally, kind of by default in machines, if we humans give them any particular goal. And rather than denying that they have goals, which would be kind of silly, you know, if you're chased by a heat-seeking missile, you're not going to say, oh, I'm not worried because machines can't have goals. We should simply figure out the answer to these research questions about how you can have machines learn, understand, adopt, retain goals, and also this very important question that you brought up here, whose goals?
Right. Let me go to the phones. Let's go to Wagner, South Dakota. Todd, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on. The question I think about when I think about artificial intelligence is aren't we just recreating ourselves? Aren't we really, when we talk about creating intelligence, we're just talking about replicating ourselves. It's our progeny that we're creating. And when we send our real progeny out in the world, we're not afraid of them. And we don't try to dictate what the next generation is going to look like. We just hope we've done a good job in creating them.
I think that's a beautiful metaphor you make there. We can think of perhaps Life 3.0 as the progeny of the children, not of us as individuals, but of humanity. But there's also a caution in there, right? If we have a child that goes out and does great things, fulfills all these dreams that we couldn't realize ourselves but wished we had, and then carries on our ideals and remembers us, we'll feel proud of them, even if the children outlast us. But if we instead give birth to Adolf Hitler, who kills us and does things we think are horrible, we would not feel so great. And that's why we put so much effort into how we raise our children, what values we instill in them. And I'm saying, in the same way, we should be very responsible if we give rise to these intelligent machines, how we raise them and what values we imbue into them.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we will get to a point where AI looks so natural, you know, that it'll pass the Turing test immediately? You won't be able to tell it from a person, a robot?
I think there's been so much spectacular progress recently in the field, and there's every indication that, yeah, that's where things are going. There's huge disagreement among the leading experts about whether it's going to happen in 30 years or 100 years. But I think the trend is obvious, and I think there's nothing impossible about it. We have a tendency, I think, also to maybe underestimate a little bit the progress of technology, because first, we sort of define intelligence as that which machines still can't do, right? I remember when people used to think it was really intelligent to play chess. And then 20 years ago, when Deep Blue from IBM beat Garry Kasparov, people started saying, well, that's not real intelligence. And again and again and again, now machines can suddenly drive cars, they can translate between English and Chinese, they can do this and that. But that's not real intelligence. But if you look at the actual list of things that we humans can still do, the machines can't, it keeps shrinking. And I don't see any fundamental reason why it won't shrink to zero unless we screw up in some other way and destroy ourselves and just don't create technology. I want to just stress also, especially since the word technology is in the name of the university where I work, that I don't think we should try to stop technology. I think it's impossible. Every way in which 2017 is better than the Stone Age is because of technology. But rather, we should try to create a great future with it by winning this race between the growing power of the technology and the growing wisdom with which we manage it. And there, I really think we have a challenge, because we're so used to staying ahead in this wisdom race by learning from mistakes. You know, we invented fire and oopsie, and then we invented the fire extinguisher. We invented cars, screwed up a bunch of times, then we invented the seatbelt and the airbag. But with more powerful technology like nuclear weapons and superhuman AI, we don't want to learn from mistakes, Ira. That's a terrible strategy. We want to prepare, do AI safety research, get things right the first time, because that's probably the only time we have. And I think we can do it if we really plan carefully.
I'm Ira Flato. We're talking with Max Tegmark, author of Life 3.0, Being Human in the Age of Artificial Intelligence, on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. In the few minutes we have left, Max, what about the recent letter to the UN? Should these types of autonomous weapons be banned?
I think we should absolutely have some sort of international arms control convention on killer robots, just like we have had that for bioweapons and chemical weapons. And I'm actually cautiously optimistic that this will also happen, because the end point of such an arms race and kill robots is obvious. It's going to weaken the U.S. and China and Russia and the other most powerful nations at the expense of terrorist groups and other non-state actors who don't have the wherewithal to develop their own stuff. And the reason for this is because killer robots, AI weapons, are very different from nuclear weapons. They don't require anything expensive or hard to access materials. And once you can, if superpowers start an arms race, then before long, and mass produce them cheaply, then before long, you know, North Korea will be doing it too, and before long you'll be able to buy them with $400 in Bitcoin anonymously, and it's going to be the Kalashnikovs of tomorrow, completely unstoppable. And these are just to give a little color to this. I mean, if you can buy a little bumblebee-sized drone for a few hundred bucks and just program in the ethnic group you want to kill or the address and photo of the one you want to assassinate, and then it goes and does that and self-destructs anonymously, just imagine what mayhem that would wreak, you know, with our open society. None of the superpowers really wants this. And if they get together in the UN in November now and decide that to really stigmatize this with an international treaty, I think we can end up in this nice situation where when people look back at AI in 20 years, they're going to mainly associate it with new ways of making society better, not with new ways of killing people. Just like if you ask someone today what they associate with biology, they're mainly going to say medicines, not bioweapons. Ask someone what they think about chemistry, they'll say, oh, new materials. They're not going to say mainly chemical weapons. That's because those scientists, the biologists and chemists, really went to bat in the past for there being an international ban. They succeeded. And what we see now is very strong support from AI researchers to similarly use AI as a force for good, not just start a stupid arms race that nobody wants.
You're a physicist by trade. What got you to focus on AI now?
Honestly, ever since I was a teenager, I was fascinated by big questions. And the two biggest of all always felt like understanding the mysteries of our universe out there and our universe in here, in our minds. And I spent a lot of time, as you know, doing research in cosmology. But in the last few years here at MIT, I've shifted my research towards AI and related things, because I feel that we physicists have a lot to contribute to that area, actually. Many biologists feel that you'll never be able to understand the brain, for example, until you understand every little detail about synapses and neurons and so on. Whereas we physicists are the most audacious scientists. You know, we'll look at a complicated coffee cup that someone has stirred and have the audacity to try to describe the waves in there without even worrying about the atoms that it's made of or anything. Mm-hmm. And I think similarly, there's a lot of hidden simplicity that remains to be discovered about intelligence machines and intelligent brains that can be understood long before we get into the weeds.
All right.
On these things.
That's a very Richard Feynman-like comment. I want to end it right there. He was one of my great heroes. Max Tegmark is for physics at MIT. His new book is Life 3.0, Being Human in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. And we have an excerpt on our website at sciencefriday.com/Tegmark. Thank you, Max. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Have a great weekend. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
You're welcome. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you missed it, you can re-listen on our podcast. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com, Facebook, Twitter, or everywhere in social media. So every